This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, our guest is Professor Ty Newell. Welcome, Ty.
It's good to be here.
We're going to be talking about your travel across the country in an electric car, a plug-in car.
Yeah.
Why did you buy one?
Well, maybe to make a long story short, I'm driven to live every day on our solar energy allowance, and an electric vehicle is a piece of that puzzle. And so as soon as I could buy one, I did.
Now, who made the electric car that you bought?
This car is a Ford Focus Electric, and there's a lot of exciting electrics coming out, but the Ford Focus Electric is made in Detroit, and so it's American ingenuity, and it's just a wonderful car.
Now, as a professional engineer, you say there was a variety, and that's one reason you might choose it, but how does it stack up with the other electric vehicles in terms of technical stuff that I wouldn't understand?
Yeah. But it's at the top of the list for, say, a general-use family-type car. Compared to, for example, the Nissan Leaf, which is a very similar car in range, maybe about 70 miles on a charge, the Ford Focus right now charges twice as fast, about 3 hours for a charge compared to about six. But the Leaf's going to change, and it may already have changed with that faster charging. Compared to the Tesla Roadster, which and the new Tesla sedan car coming out, it doesn't have as fast of charge capability or as far of a range, but that's also a little bit more expensive vehicle.
Isn't it quite expensive, the Tesla, actually?
Yeah, the Tesla Roadster is about a $100,000 to $150,000 car.
Because that's a sports car, right?
Yeah, and that's just a wonderful sports car. You know, 0 to 60 in under 4 seconds. It's hard to find any vehicle that will do that. And where the Ford Focus is still much, as an electric vehicle, much better performing car than a gas car. I rented a regular Ford Focus just the other week, just for the heck of it, to see how it compared. And you know, when you stomp on the pedal, it's mush compared to an electric car that gives you 100% torque at zero RPM.
Wow. And how much did the Ford Focus cost, if we could be that
basic? Oh, for sure. Yeah, typically the electrics, like the Focus, they're $40,000 cars with a $7,500 federal tax credit, which a lot of people don't agree with, but my thinking is that it's the one time I've gotten to say where a bit of my taxes go. And if I didn't pay taxes, I wouldn't get that credit. So those are my taxes that are getting credited a little bit. And I much prefer that money being directed toward employment in Detroit as opposed to being shipped overseas for imported oil. But as far as the economics work out, so this car, then with that tax credit, it's about a $32,000 car. And a fully outfitted Ford Focus would be about a $24,000 car. So there's maybe $8,000 to $10,000 difference. But what's really exciting is that the electric energy for this car, and this would be solar-powered electricity, so if you have solar panels generating electricity that,
like
then,
you do at your home.
Like I do at my house, yeah. That's about 2 to 3 cents per mile for solar-generated energy to propel this car compared to a good gas vehicle, which is about 13 cents per mile for gasoline at the $3 to $4 per gallon range. And over 100,000 miles, that 10 cents per mile difference between the two, that's $10,000, the price differential.
Oh.
But the amazing economic difference is that where more than 50% of that $10,000 in gas or oil costs would have been shipped out of the U.S., I instead spent that $10,000 in Detroit for batteries, for an electric motor, for employment of people.
Now, when you took this trip with the car, you can go 70 miles and you have to recharge it.
Yeah. Well, 60 miles, just so we leave a little. Yeah, we didn't want to call it that close, although at one point we did. But we.
This is you and your wife.
Yeah. And okay. So Deb was kind of a willing participant in it. It took a little coaxing. But when the Ford Focus first came out, about last March, you could start ordering them. I immediately got my order in. And you could only buy them in New York, New Jersey, and California. And so I called up a dealer in New York that was certified to sell them. Only a few dealers, about six in New York, six in New Jersey, and a dozen in California, are certified. And it happened to be close to Deb's hometown where she grew up. And so we could visit relatives and pick up this car and tool around Long Island for a few days to get used to it. And then kind of the premise for the trip and driving home was that we recreated a historic automobile journey that was taken in 1901 by a fellow named Roy Chapin. And Roy Chapin at that time was in his early 20s. He was an engineer and was working for Oldsmobile. And Oldsmobile's very first car, the Curved Dash Olds, which was one of the first mass-produced cars, he drove the car from Detroit to New York the very first time that had been done, and it was an amazing journey because cars at that time, whether gas, steam, or electric, were considered just around-the-town vehicles, that they could never be used for such travel. And so he drove to New York just in time for the New York Auto Show, which was just in its infancy. That was the second time that was held. And made tremendous headlines around the country and around the world with this amazing journey. So we wanted to recreate Roy's trip in reverse, taking the electric car from New York back to Detroit. And Roy Chapin went on to, after Oldsmobile, founding Hudson Motor Car Company. And just a little family history, my grandfather, my dad, and my uncles all worked for Hudson. My grandfather was one of the early Hudson employees. And, of course, you knew my dad, who then became a Presbyterian preacher as the calling, as he felt that. But cars are in our family's blood. And so I looked at the route, and it looked like we could get an electric charge about every 60 miles with these charging stations that are popping up around the country. And when we got to Detroit, we went to the Ford, to the Michigan assembly plant, the Ford factory where the Focus is made. And I had set up with some former students who are Ford engineers to get to tour the plant.
Huh.
And what was really fun was that once we arrived at the plant, they surprised us with Bill Chapin, who's about my age, about 60, who's a grandson of Roy Chapin. And he was just tickled because, you know, his grandfather's not very well remembered for that feat. But it really was an amazing Roy's journey. Mine was much more comfortable.
1901 was the drive in the Oldsmobile by Roy Chapin from Detroit to New York.
Yeah, and wow. He was driving on cow paths, the towpath of the Erie Canal. And, of course, he had to carry all his fuel, spare parts. He was pumping up his tires manually every couple of miles. And so Deb and I just had to stop every – our biggest hardship was that we were gaining weight because when you are charging for 3 hours, you have a very luxurious lunch.
And what do you do? Yeah.
And we'd get our folding bicycles out and then ride around a bit and have some fun.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Professor Ty Newell, Professor Emeritus from the University of Illinois in Engineering, about his trip across the country in an electric battery-powered Ford Focus. And we're not accepting calls today. We've had to pre-record this program because of scheduling difficulties, so we won't be able to take your calls. I know this would be a show where a lot of people would have questions, but I'll just have to do my best to anticipate what some of those questions are, and perhaps we can have Professor Newell on a later time when we can have calls, when he's had more experience with this vehicle. Now, you bought this Ford Focus Electric in what month?
In July. Well, ordered it online in March. And then it came in the 1st of July. So we flew to New York July 2nd, picked it up that day, and then tooled around the city a bit, New York City and Long Island.
And how long did it take you to get to Detroit from New York?
Less than a week, like 6 days or so. It was about 1,000 miles going the direction we went. We left on July 8th, which coincidentally is the day that the Declaration of Independence was read in New York City to General Washington and his troops. And to me, I liken it a lot to Independence Day, you know, feeling some freedom that I can produce the power needed for our transportation now.
And did you make it without running out of battery?
Yeah. We had a very comfortable, casual drive. One of the fun things we did was we stopped at the summer camp where Deb and I met in what's called upstate New York, but it's really 60 miles north of New York City. And
what camp was that?
Holmes Presbyterian Camp and Conference Center. And I was the maintenance guy there, and Deb was a lifeguard and counselor, and so it was a camp romance. And unknown to Deb, I arranged for us to be married again, which our plan was always to be married at camp. But then, as other things dictated, we weren't able to do that when we were married back in 74. And I'm not known as somebody who prearranges or thinks ahead very often in issues like that. So it was a complete surprise to Deb as we pulled up to camp to visit that some familiar faces were there that she just thought by coincidence they just happened to be there. And then I proposed to her by the lake where we intended to be married. And then, you know, kind of a stunned look in her face as she realized I wasn't kidding.
Did she say yes?
And she did say yes. Oh, she had a chance to. You know, really, I'm not a very easy person to live with. So she had her chance, but agreed again and has since somewhat regretted that. But we just had a wonderful time. One of our friends from camp who sang at our wedding sang, and the camp director married us again, and so we just had it was a wonderful way to start the trip off.
When you and Deb got married back in 74, you didn't warn her that she would be living eventually in a house that didn't have any electricity coming in from outside?
Well, she knew that, you know, similar to your calling, I've just felt this calling that, you know, we have to live on our daily allowance of solar energy. And so she's realized that from that time. Maybe she didn't realize that it would become real, and I'm maybe a little slow on take up. It took me about four decades longer than I thought, but we're here at last. And so and I think she's enjoying the comfort of our home as well as this vehicle, which is her daily vehicle to drive now.
And how does it feel to drive an electric car? You said it actually has a more pickup than a typical car of that size.
You know, there's no transmission, so there's no shifting. It's extremely smooth. You just step on it, and really the limitation is what the engineers program in for pickup. So they've kept it pretty car feeling-like, but at the same time much spunkier, and we call it more gliding than, because you're really gliding along fairly silently, and it's just extremely comfortable car.
Now, from the outside, it has the same appearance of a contemporary Ford Focus, right?
Yeah, and that, you know, the car can either look like a regular car or they can make it different. And Ford chose a very interesting tack, which is to build this car on the exact same production line as the gas Focus and the Focus Hybrid, and then a new model called the C-Max. And it's this concept gets used in other factories as well, but as cars are ordered, they're built to order. And so instead of a gas engine, transmission, and exhaust system coming in, a battery pack and electric motor gets put in the Focuses that are designated electric.
Where do they put the battery pack? I have a hybrid car. The battery for my Honda Civic Hybrid is behind the back seat.
Yeah, and that's the same on this. There's a battery pack underneath the car, and then there's one in the storage about the size of a suitcase. And since you're typically not going more than 70 miles, and most people won't decide to go off on a trek like we did, you really don't need, that suitcase size piece. But in our case, we each had a suitcase and a folding bicycle and then a few bags of stuff, and it was plenty of room to move across country.
But as a compact car, this car is designed to carry four people.
Yeah, four to five in the Focus Electric, and it's really, it's exactly the same interior-wise as a Focus.
Now, it does say electric on
yeah,
the
it's
side
got a
and on
badge
the back
on it,
of the
yeah.
car.
Some people curse it as thinking, all of this wasted government money, which, in Ford's case, nothing went in. But the reality is that it's no different than any other car they've developed as far as the cost. And when you go in the factory, you see that, it's not like they're shoving gold and diamonds in the car. It's the same cost as any other car. Just like flat screen TVs, the interesting thing about an electric car is it's really a much less expensive car than a gas car. You got one moving part in the motor, and that's the rotor, where in a gas car you got thousands of parts from valves and springs and cams. And so this car, just like the flat-screen TV, is actually a less expensive technology than the old CRT television, tube televisions. This electric car is less expensive than a gas car, but it's got to mature and increase in volume before that economy kicks in.
Now, as a car guy, you've probably followed very closely the bailout of Chrysler and GM, but not Ford. Why was Ford able to do better than the other two at that point?
Well, I think there's always luck involved, and Ford, I think, has been fortunate to be hitting this track earlier. But GM and Chrysler are getting it together and developing excellent cars, and they'll all be in the mix, and. I don't have a problem with the government loaning money like that. I think they're getting a good bang for their buck. And really, thousands and thousands of jobs were at stake. And rather than these companies going bankrupt and getting sold for 10 cents on the dollar, that they've been able to rebuild their value and preserve jobs that would have otherwise been lost.
We're about 20 minutes into Keeping the Faith this Sunday evening, and we're talking with Ty Newell, a professor emeritus from the University of Illinois in engineering. We'll be getting back to him in just a moment, but let me mention to listeners what's coming up in the weeks ahead on Keeping the Faith. On December 23rd, Sam Smith will be our guest, talking about community engagement. He is the community engagement director at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. That'll be a live show December 23rd. The show today with Ty was pre-recorded, so we're not accepting calls during this hour. On December 30, we'll be playing an archive program with Professor Gary Wills from Northwestern about his new book about the ancient Christian saints Ambrose and Augustine and the mystery of baptism. His new book from Oxford University Press called Font of Life, The Mystery of Baptism. That'll be the author Gary Wills, a new book out just this year. And then on January 6th, we have a very special program planned. We're hoping we can do it. It depends partly on some international relations, but the Orthodox Christmas Eve begins on January 6th, and we hope to have a show where we'll be talking live with a pastor who's in Bethlehem on the West Bank in Palestine. So that'll be a special show by phone January 6th, we hope. Let me make a couple of announcements. There's a musical program this evening, December 16, 2012, at Holy Cross Catholic Church that listeners may wish to attend. It's put on by the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana. It costs $20. $10 for students, and it's a festival of music with the Bach Chorus and Orchestra and the University High School Madrigals. So a Baroque Christmas tonight, 7:30 at Holy Cross Catholic Church. And coming up December 30 is a concert at the Vineyard on North Lincoln Avenue by the Chorale, A World in Tune, Winter Around the World. It will include the strings from the Urbana Pop Orchestra. It will include a couple soloists who received Young Artist Scholarships from the Chorale, Molly Netter, soprano, and Derek Benefiore playing the piano. The Chorale, directed by Julie Beiler, and this program also costs a little bit, $20, and that's Sunday, December 30 at the Vineyard Church on North Lincoln Avenue. Well, getting back to our guest today, Ty Newell, tell us what you taught at the university all these years.
I was a faculty member in mechanical engineering, in the mechanical science and engineering department, and my career has just continually revolved around renewable energy, energy efficiency, and resource conservation. And so my research really has been studying all the facets of this, from the basic technologies in an air conditioner, how to make an air conditioner more efficient, to a lot of building monitoring, a lot of building simulation, trying to understand the processes, the energy flows, and that are required to keep us comfortable and do the things we need for daily life.
And on Keeping the Faith, we do talk about issues of ethics and values. And we last had you on the show when you were talking about the Solar Decathlon House that professors and students here at the University of Illinois developed a few years back and did very well in an international competition.
Yeah, in the Solar Decathlon, and I'd urge listeners to look up Solar Decathlon, do a search on that. You'll find several years now of competitions that 20 universities compete, and now it's expanded to a decathlon that's being held in China, ones that are being held in Europe. And I was involved in the 2007 decathlon with colleague Michael McCulley, who on the architectural side is one of the innovators of some of the lowest energy homes to be designed and built. And since that time, the University of Illinois is in the 2009 decathlon with Mark Taylor, a faculty member in architecture, and they came in second, which is a tremendous accomplishment. And then they were in the 2011, and now they're in upcoming 2013 one that's being held in China. But out of that experience, that let me take a lot of the things we had learned in the lab, a lot of things we had learned by monitoring and modeling, and put that into a real home design. And that's when Deb and I then decided to build our own home, so that, you know, put your money where your mouth is. But when you're writing your own checks, as opposed to the usual type of grants or things that we might operate on in a research type atmosphere, I knew how much by building and designing the home in this manner, how much we spent on nails, how much went into electrical, how much went into plumbing, trenching, site work, siding. And all of these pieces are important to make the most economical home that is also energy efficient and able to be sustainably powered. And that's the house we call Equinox, which for people interested in that, if they go to buildequinox.com, they'll find a lot of features and blogs and information on this 100% solar-powered home that has enough solar energy to also power this electric vehicle 8,000 miles a year and economically power it. It's much more cost-effective, as we mentioned, than gasoline on a per-mile basis.
And when was your Equinox house that you live in completed?
It was completed in 2010, so we've been in there a little over 2 years now, and it's just works as advertised. We're just, it's just a wonderful living space. It's the best quality home I've lived in. It, unlike typical homes, it has fresh air brought in that purges the house continuously every hour of the day, every day of the year, where our conventionally constructed homes rely on construction flaws to leak some air in. And so this house is a very healthy and comfortable house, as well as being sustainably powered.
You have passive solar.
Yes, but in a different manner than what people envision. People typically envision enormous windows in the house.
Right.
And a lot of these homes become solar cookers. You're just impacted by the sun. And on a sunny, cold day like today, they have to vent or air condition to maintain comfort. Our window design is based on daylighting and view. And so in our house, as people read through the features, we have just as many windows on the north as we do on the south because the view into our gardens, backyard gardens, is the one we want to emphasize for our pleasure. And then the windows on the south, while they provide some additional heating in the winter, they're really there for daylighting. And so it really follows more along the locale house design, which the University of Illinois was an early innovator in the 1970s.
Well,
and then Michael McCulley was one of the first people to design and build a couple of locale homes, which were built in the 1970s and are in Champaign and Urbana. And so it really follows more directly off the locale house and not emphasizing the windows, but putting in just enough for those things that we enjoy.
Tell us about insulation.
Well, insulation, Equinox House has foot-thick walls and roof that's styrofoam insulated. There's no magic insulation, whatever floats your boat as far as the type of insulation. So whether you want to use straw bales, styrofoam, fiberglass, cellulose, you take a look and decide on your own. But in our case, we use styrofoam because it's also a structural material. And so folks that go to our website, you'll see the details of that. But we use something called structural insulated panels to do that. And that keeps the house very low energy and very comfortable.
And that's at Equinox, buildequinox.com.
Buildequinox.com, yes.
Have you given a lot of tours of your house since you built it in 2010?
Yeah, a few thousand folks have come through from solar enthusiasts and ecologically minded enthusiasts, but also church groups and symphonic groups and Cub Scouts and lots of university students. And one of our goals is to make it real for people so they can walk in and see, hey, this house is comfortable. You're not wearing a winter coat to stay comfortable in the coldest days of winter, and temperature and humidity are nice during the summer. And it's got, you know, it's got a custom Italian kitchen, which is, I think, probably one of the most expensive kitchens in Champaign, Urbana, along with the highest level of appliances that one can find, nice Architect Series KitchenAid appliances.
But that all runs by solar power.
All solar powered, yeah. Yeah, so Deb's immense amount of cooking, she doesn't realize our four kids don't live with us anymore, so there's still this immense amount of cooking going on, and Thanksgiving, both double ovens are fired up, and along with the microwave and the cooktop, and that's all solar powered, every bit.
And there's a place in the garage to charge this new car.
Yeah, you know, and one of the exciting things on that you know, as people think about, well, if we have all these electric cars, where's all that electric power going to come from? You know, the electric grid has all these problems, and there's a real simple solution that is going to economically benefit our country so much, and that's the simple change of our water heater to a new technology called a heat pump water heater that you can buy in Lowe's and Home Depot, and costs you about $900 now, and I think you get maybe $300 from Ameren if you buy one. And then what's called a heat pump clothes dryer, which you can't get in this country yet because we're a little slow to catch on to some of these things, but it's a well-established technology in Europe, and so we had to bring ours in from Europe. But this water heater, this heat pump water heater, it's essentially like a window air conditioner, $150 air conditioner stuck on top of a water heating tank, and it makes your water heating twice as efficient. And a family of three to four would use about 4,000 kilowatt hours of energy to heat their water each year. With this heat pump water heater, it's about 2,000 kilowatt hours. That savings of 2,000 kilowatt hours is about 8,000 miles of driving in an electric vehicle. So if you just think about cutting your hot water energy requirement in half by using this better technology, you just did two-thirds of your driving. And then when you couple it with this heat pump clothes dryer, a family of three to four would use about 2,000 kilowatt hours for clothes drying. By saving 50% of that by a more efficient clothes dryer, and all this is a clothes dryer with a basement dehumidifier shoved inside of it. So it dehumidifies your clothes rather than superheating them like an electric regular electric dryer does.
Probably better for the clothes.
Better for the clothes, and saving another 1,000 kilowatt hours per year, that's another 4,000 miles of driving. So a clothes dryer and a water heater give you 12,000 miles of driving a year, so you don't need more electricity in your house. And the other thing that kicks in is that as you shift to this electric driving, we mentioned that there's a huge cost savings in oil, but all of a sudden you're no longer importing oil. So this $300 to $400 billion a year we're throwing outside the borders of our country, we're now putting into manufacturing electric vehicles. And what's even better is that this clothes dryer and this water heater, which have the equivalent of a window air conditioner and a basement dehumidifier coupled into them, that's more employment that's going on to then drop the energy usage for our daily needs.
Since we've needed to pre-record this program with Professor Ty Newell about the new electric vehicle that he and his family have purchased, we're not accepting calls this day, but let me ask a couple mean questions.
Sure.
I'm sure some of our listeners are thinking about. Okay, what if you do run out of power in this car? And you can't just hitch a ride and get a gas can and bring it back and fill it up. Well, do you do?
I have hitched a ride to get a can of gas, as Deb can attest, because I always like to find out where empty really was in our cars. And and normally that was with a car full of kids. And but in the electric car, of course, it gives you some warning. But you can plug it into any 120-volt outlet.
Oh, you can?
Yeah. And that's a slower charge. That charge is about a 12-hour charge instead of a 3-hour charge like the charging stations. And so, you know, you're going to have a little spare time as it's charging up. But that's what would happen.
So you carry a long extension cord.
Yeah. And, you know, when we were going through buying this car and then I was trying to figure out, okay, how do we get it back, support vehicles, carry a generator or some kind of conversion thing so I could go to a laundromat, my son Ben just said, why don't you just get in the car and drive it home? And I thought about it. I go, yeah, all right. And so that's what we did. And so we literally just threw our suitcases in and started driving back. And even at this sparse time of charging stations, we still, about every 60 miles, found a place to charge up.
And that's at a higher than 110. That's at what, 220?
Yeah. What we did overnight, stopping at motels, we then did a 120 charge because most motel parking lots do have electric receptacles in their most motels have electric receptacles in the parking lots, you know, for people in RVs or other vehicles that need plug-in. So we'd plug in there for an overnight charge. And then during the day, we'd do 2 to 3 fast charges. And these charging stations would be in municipalities that may have put in an EV charger or in shopping malls were very popular. And then just a few odd places that – there just happened to be somebody with a little bit of vision that said, let's see if we can get a charging station here.
Now, do they charge you money to use it?
The bulk of them didn't at this point. They should. And then there are commercial charging stations that, like the train station in White Plains that a company named ChargePoint, especially around metropolitan areas, have been putting these in. And they charge you a couple bucks for a charge.
Do you know what the overall plan is for charging stations since so many more companies are making these electric vehicles, these EV cars?
Yeah, it's going to be very dynamic. There's one company that's looking at kind of a universal battery that gets unplugged and plugged in. So you pull into, a equivalent of a gas station, and this mechanism just pops that battery out and puts the other one in within 5 minutes. But there's also rapid advances, like folks in our material science department here in battery charging and storage technologies, where it's going to be like a lightning bolt hitting your car, and it'll just be charged in an instant. And maybe these charging stations will be embedded in the road so that as you're driving along the roads, they're just inductively coupled, keeping you charged up. So in Deb and my case, where we were stopping every 60 miles, which it relieved us of our usual argument of when to stop for a bathroom break, we were stopping more than frequently enough for that. But where I think people when driving from New York to L.A. are going to be crying for a bathroom break because the car just never needs to be taken off the road for a charge.
If they develop that technology.
Yeah. And so whether that's, my lifetime or that. But the exciting thing is that the technology is here now for creating true independence from fossil fuels, that transportation piece coupled with living on renewable energy. All the technologies are here and off the shelf and at economic prices now.
When you moved into your Equinox house that's 100% powered by solar.
Yeah. Plus we do rainwater collection. So
what did the neighbors think?
Well, they were worried a little bit when they saw the frame for the solar collectors going in because we ground mounted them in the backyard. Because we want people to be able to go up close and look around them, kick the tires, and just see what they look like. And some of our neighbors thought that we were putting in a soccer field and that was a bleacher. I don't know if they like the solar collectors any better than a set of bleachers. But, the general comments have been very positive. And so I think people are truly excited to see that, here's a regular house in a regular subdivision that's 100% solar powered.
How high are the solar panels?
We have a berm in the backyard, so they're just mounted off that. But they're at about a 30-degree angle, and so they're just high enough to be conveniently placed, but also high enough that they're not in the way as far as mowing or doing things underneath for maintenance.
We have about 20 minutes left on our Keeping the Faith program this afternoon. We're talking with Ty Newell, retired professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Illinois, about his recent trip across the country in an electric car. We'll get back to that in just a minute. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and if you've missed part of this program, you can hear it when it becomes an archive at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. Leave the G off of keeping. We're very informal here. And you'll find all of this program and previous programs going back several years, including an earlier program where we interviewed Professor Newell about the solar decathlon house at the University of Illinois. This is a program we've pre-recorded, so we're not accepting calls during this hour, but we will be doing that next week. When we go back to live Keeping the Faith shows. Ty, let's talk a little bit about some people are afraid of being in an accident in a battery-powered car. Is there battery acid that's going to fly over all kinds of people if there's a wreck?
No, for powering a car, you want to think in terms of the energy capacity that's in the car for driving at a certain distance. And the amount of energy that's in a tank of gasoline is about 5 times greater than the amount of chemically stored energy, but what's converted to electrical energy for an electric vehicle. And that's because a typical gas-powered car wastes about 80% of that energy in the tank. It gets turned into exhaust gas, the heat coming out the tailpipe and the heat coming out the radiator. And only 20% of that's actually delivered to your wheels. In an electric car, almost 100% of that goes right from the energy stored into the wheels. There's some loss, of course, but it's a fairly small fraction. So the actual energy in a car just isn't that great.
What about battery replacement costs?
Yeah, and these cars are coming out with like 10-year, 100,000-mile warranties, and so if we get that, I think the price is to be determined, so I don't think people know that. But, let's say I know for my Honda Insight that's about a $2,600 replacement, and this is maybe five times the capacity, so maybe it's $10,000. But what's going to happen in this, the same as will happen with like the solar panel technology, is that not only is manufacturing volumes increase and the manufacturing increase drives prices down, but also as the recycling infrastructure develops so that all the hard work has already been done as far as the materials that are in the batteries or in solar panels. And just like an aluminum can made from old aluminum cans only needs about 10% of the energy to remanufacture it compared to virgin ore. The same is true of solar panels and all these others. With an efficient recycling system set up, that the new batteries made from old batteries, the new solar panels made from old solar panels, will cost a fraction of it. So there's going to be this wave of additional price decreases after this first generation moves back.
When you were on this trip with your wife, Deb, from New York to Detroit and then from Detroit to Champaign-Urbana, what did you tell the motels where you parked? Did you tell them, hey, I'm going to plug in my car and use your electricity all night?
Or? Yeah. But they were used to that from RVs and stuff. But one bed and breakfast, I said, you know, we have an electric car and we'd like to plug in. And so, you know, they found a receptacle in the garage that we could plug into. Oh. And, most people are very, very curious. And I first tell them, it'll just increase your electric bill about $100 for the month. And so, and then I explained, you know, really we're using about 80 cents or a dollar of electricity.
Overnight.
Yeah. So, it just really isn't that much. You figure 60 miles of driving. That's going to be about 10, 12 kilowatt hours, and that's about 10 cents a kilowatt hour in a lot of places. So a $1.20 was, you know, the electric cost.
Oh. Now, you've had a hybrid vehicle for how many years?
Well, we got ours in 2001, 2002. As soon as I could order a Honda Insight, I went and ordered that, and we're still driving that around.
Have you had to replace the battery?
The batteries went out at 8 years, and fortunately it was an 8-year warranty, and we still had a couple months, so it did get replaced free of charge.
Oh.
Yeah.
And how do the two vehicles compare in terms of feel, a hybrid electric and gas, and then an all-electric?
Yeah. In the Honda, and you mentioned you have the Civic hybrid.
Right.
Hybrid. And that's a different technology than the Prius like the Chevy Volt type drivetrains. It's more of a low-end turbo. That motor is in line with the engine and gives you kind of a low-end boost to torque, as well as absorbs energy when you're braking and puts that in the batteries. But the Focus electric vehicle is much better performing than the Priuses and Insights and other gas engine cars, because they're still basically gas engine vehicles. Now, we had a Chevy Volt for a week through a GM program, and that's a sharp performing car in both electric and gas. But that's this new wave of hybrids where you plug in and you're fully on electric, and then it seamlessly converts into a gas engine once your electric's used up. And that car, similar to the Ford Focus electric, you step on it, it's going to go. And there's a lot of vehicles. Ford's new C-Max has that kind of plug-in electric then gas type of drivetrain too.
I know is it Tesla that's got that's so expensive, but also so much fun to drive as a sports car and so fast.
Yeah. I always like to point out that the visionary who put Tesla together in the first place, Martin Eberhard's a U of I grad. And so
is he?
I always like to point out how U of I alums have really contributed to society. But he was a visionary who saw where electric vehicles could go and that they didn't have to look like golf carts, as a lot of people imagine.
And is that company going to make it financially, or is it too soon to tell?
I don't know. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's always a lot of gambling, a lot of risk, a lot of money at stake. But I've got no doubt about electric vehicles that they're just going to take off. And as people test drive them, they're going to really enjoy the performance of the car in addition to finding this big cost benefit on the dollars per mile they'll spend.
So you probably met some interesting people and had some interesting questions on this cross-country six-day
yeah.
trip you took, stopping every 60 or 70 miles to recharge. Tell us about some of the characters you met.
Yeah. One of the most interesting was a fellow who, about my age, about 60, and we were in a parking lot at a charging station in St. Clair, Michigan, a beautiful spot on the St. Clair River. Connecting Detroit to Port Huron. And this guy walks by the car and sees it being charged up, and he walks through that parking lot every day. He's in a Burger King outfit on his way to work. And I'm sure he saw that parking, that space never having a car plugged in, because most of the places where I'd ask, they hadn't seen a car for a couple of months. But he saw our car there, and he made a couple of disparaging remarks about his tax dollars paying for the car. And Deb was over talking with one of our kids on the phone, and I immediately hopped on this guy saying, look, you know, this car, you didn't pay a dime for it, you know, and this was built in Detroit, and I'm a Detroit native. I was born in Detroit, so that tends to also feed into wanting a car manufactured there. But I explained to him how gas engine cars, you know, we really are shipping money, a lot of money, $300-400 billion a year, across our borders of people that don't like us very much and are turning those dollars into bombs and bullets. And I said, I'm sending my money to Detroit. So the extra money I paid on this car, this went to employ. It turned out this guy was a Chrysler worker and who then had lost a lot of his pension in a lot of the restructuring, and very bitter. But as he heard me explaining how I wanted money to go into Detroit, it was really an interesting turnaround. And Deb was on the phone with our daughter, Dana, saying, I think your dad's about to get into a fight, because it was fairly heated looking. And then next thing she knows, she sees us kind of yucking it up, and we're talking about, because I'm a big Chrysler fan too. I was East Central Illinois' largest collector of Chrysler Imperials, 1962 Chrysler Imperials. I had two of them, which anybody that knows about that, it's also the very best demolition derby car that's ever been built. But
very heavy car.
But a very ingenious but very inefficient car, but a wonderfully creative vehicle. And so he and I were swapping stories, but, you know, he saw where I was coming from, and I hope this story spans the spectrum from Tea Partiers to Occupy Wall Street, that we really can strengthen our local communities through these technologies, that it's employment, it's local labor for installing these things, from rainwater collection to solar panels. And while we're not going to see it directly, we're going to start feeling a lot richer as we start keeping that $300-400 billion inside our borders and start spending it on manufacturing. And other countries that follow this renewable and energy efficiency path are going to be feeling that same thing.
My wife, Nadja, and I live on one of the few little hills here in Champaign
yeah.
County. And from the side of the hill where we are on Yankee Ridge, we can see 20 miles away the red lights that have appeared
yeah.
over the last 2 years
yeah.
across the horizon of the turbines,
yeah.
the electric generating windmills.
Yeah.
And you can they're so distinctive. And
yeah.
They all are at the same height, and they all blink in
yeah.
unison.
Yeah.
And it's a new thing, and it reminds us every clear night Boy, things are changing.
They are changing. And you know, while there's a lot of debate about these, people really need to think in terms of the independence that this is going to create, the employment, and the employment is just compared to the fossil fuel industry, there's 10 times more jobs in the renewable industry. And all you have to do is go to Fortune magazine and look up employment versus revenue dollars. And you find that companies that make real things like Whirlpool making appliances or a John Deere or a Caterpillar making machinery or a solar panel or a wind turbine company, they employ about 2 to 4 people per $1 million of revenue, where oil companies and similar energy companies only employ about 0.2 to 0.4 people per $1 million of revenue. They're right up there with investment banks and insurance companies that we all know about from the 2008 debacle. And so there's so much more employment that's going to strengthen local communities. And, of course, at the end of a wind turbine's lifetime, it gets built back into a new wind turbine. All those parts in the generator get reformed. All those gears get reformed into new gears, as opposed to a piece of land that you can't use for thousands and thousands of years, or some unseen hole over in Kentucky that you can look at on Google Earth that all of this coal was dredged out of, and now it's got all of these toxic wastes that the local inhabitants, to our benefit, have been stuck with. And so even with that debate on turbines, it really is creating a freedom and a job. It's creating employment in our rural communities that have been leaving in droves, and it's going to, I think, be a lifeblood, of activity in our rural areas again.
Is it too soon to tell how well the all-electric vehicles like the Ford Focus are selling?
I think so. It's spotty now. I mean, it's such a trickle. 10,000 volts, probably similar numbers of Nissan Leafs. Ford is just trickling them out even slower rate to just kind of see, they've got to train all their dealerships. They've got to train people along their supply chain and how to manage and take care of them. But there's no doubt about the performance, and there's more than enough experience on the batteries from hybrids now that have been out for a decade. And so I think they're very confident on the technology, but the marketing's all got to, start to take root.
Now, the hybrids have sold so well, particularly with fuel prices going up and up.
Yeah.
Is that going to lead into the all-electric?
For sure that would accelerate it. But $3 to $4 gasoline is, that's plenty. As I mentioned, driving an electric car really is about a quarter of the cost per mile of gasoline, with 10 cent per kilowatt hour electric versus $3 to $4 per gallon gasoline. And, so on that basis, there's no question that it's going to take over gasoline. And another benefit on the health side, instead of spending 12 hours a year at the gas pump inhaling those fumes while you're filling up your car, you don't have that with an electric vehicle. You just plug it in like your cell phone each evening, and it'll be charged in the morning. And you're not, I both dislike getting a whiff of these obnoxious fumes, but also I kind of seethe thinking of money going to people that don't like us very much and are rubbing their hands as they're getting my money to turn that back on me in ways that we don't find pleasant.
Now, we're two males sitting here talking about cars. What does Deb think of it? Do you say she drives it every day?
Oh, yeah, she drives every day. She loves it. And Clara Ford, Henry Ford's wife, she drove an electric car. So while Henry was producing all these gas engines, she drove an electric car because, back then, it was quiet, and you didn't have to crank it to start it. And, of course, that's not a problem for us now. But, Deb likes performance. She's known to get a few speeding tickets. And so this car will allow her to get some more tickets if she's not careful.
Does it can you choose colors now?
Yeah. Okay. It really is a Ford Focus. So you go through the same ordering process. instead of choosing a gas engine, you choose the electric drivetrain. And and then when we visited the factory, it was just very interesting watching you know, all the parts come together. It's a fascinating tour. You know, anytime you have a chance to go see, to a factory, to see how all these thousands of parts come together. But it really, without skipping a beat, they just put batteries in instead of you know, gas tank and exhaust and that.
Oh.
And there's no oil changes in this car. No air filter changes. No fuel filter changes. No
spark plugs.
Yep, no muffler to have to replace. And the batteries the brakes should never need replacing because you're really electronically braking.
Oh. When your kids come to visit you, do they like to drive it?
Yeah, they drive it around, and yeah, it's a fun car to drive. But the most spectacular thing about it is that it really is just a nice car.
When you were talking about the Hudson, my father loved cars, and when he was driving in the 30s, he always tried to have interesting cars. By the time he had four sons, then we were buying the kind of Hudsons that looked like an upside-down bathtub.
Yeah, yeah. They called them a hash because Nash took over Hudson.
Right.
That's when my dad left Hudson and went to Oldsmobile, which had the hot car in the early 50s. But Nash Calvinator was an appliance manufacturer, and they basically turned the Hudson into a car that looked like a refrigerator or a bathtub going down the road. So,
and those cars that you and I remember from the 60s and 50s that were so huge,
yeah,
the ones with the big
two-tone
tail fins
and
all that, we've really seen a remarkable change just in how cars are designed, even gasoline ones, to be much more efficient.
Oh, yeah. Form and function have been put together so that you have this beautiful styling that's also got engineering in it, so it's energy efficient. And that's what was lacking. As there are some cars that were designed in those early years where, as the stylists were totally independent of the engineering, where as they put on all these fins and that to make it look aerodynamic, they're, of course, making it much less than aerodynamic. And there are some cars that were actually more efficient when they went backwards as far as their aerodynamic drag than forwards. And so you've got to have the engineering coupled in, which is also one of the problems in our residential market, that homes are not engineered. And when you decouple the engineering, you get a lot of inefficiency, which is why the building and housing market represent the biggest energy consumption sectors of our economy, but at the same time could really be the smallest sector if they were appropriately designed.
We are out of time, and I want to thank our guest today, Professor Ty Newell, Emeritus from the University of Illinois, mechanical engineer, talking about energy-efficient cars and homes. A reminder, there's a concert tonight at Holy Cross Catholic Church, A Baroque Christmas, $20 admission, $10 for students. And coming up on Sunday, December 30 at 7 o'clock at the Vineyard, the Corral. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your regular host for Keeping the Faith. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
As 2012 draws to a close, please take a moment to think of how much you've listened and relied on the programming from WILL. Then make your contribution today. Your gift will be tax deductible, and it allows us to invest in the outstanding programs you listen to every day. You can help us reach the goal of raising $1 million by December 31st when you donate online at willpledge.org. On behalf of all the listeners of WIL.